Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
Second Amendment Outdoors in Corinth, America's largest online firearms and accessory mall, has the best deals for you to stay loaded and ready, as well as covered head-to-toe in all the best brands. Whatever the season, whatever your game, our focus is all in the name. SecondAmendmentOutdoors.com, where freedom meets the field.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert is on the air. Middays with Gerard Gibbert is powered by CSpire. Power your home or business with CSpire fiber. To learn more, visit supertalk.fm/CSpire. CSpire fiber powers Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. Hello. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
And welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Rhino in the Element Wealth Studio, guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music. Morning there, Rhino.
Howdy, howdy.
Have you recovered from the Radiothon, Palmer Home Radiothon, last Thursday? And then, of course, you're a bit lighter now. I didn't recognize you at first because you don't have as much hair and no longer have the beard. So, have you recovered from that? You doing all right?
For the most part, yeah. I've gotten multiple questions about whether or not I would consider dyeing my beard because of the gray in it.
Yeah.
And the first thing that comes to mind is, well, it's too late now. I've got a kind of public-facing job, and everybody's already seen it with the gray, so not going to be fooling anybody.
Well, at least for now, you're freshly coiffed and shaven, but that won't last very long as everything starts growing out. Then we'll be back up there again for another fabulous radiothon, raising a bunch of money.
Be here before we know it.
Yeah. And then we're going to hit that goal, and we're going to coif and shave you all over again. That's the deal. So yesterday, July the 13th, was the anniversary, marked one day since an assassin attempted.
One year,
to the day is what I meant to say. Yep. 1 year to the day that an assassin, July 13th, 2024, attempted to take the president's life. I don't think there's any question about that, as we all now know. The bullet.
Not for sane people, no.
Right, exactly. The bullet, of course, ended up grazing his ear. And just watching those videos again, because it unfolded live. That's what's so crazy about it. And watching that replay again over the weekend, it's surreal, honestly. And, of course, the president being surrounded by Secret Service, and then the crowd in the background starting to slump down, trying to, like, what do you do, though? I mean, you're just a sitting duck right there. Oh, man. Well, numerous reports, and a final report has been issued. And the president says he's good with the report. It is described, the failure of the Secret Service, as a cascade of preventable failures. This is the Senate report. That's the way it was described. And this contributed to the assassination attempt. You know, there was a firefighter, of course, Pennsylvania firefighter, who lost his life and left behind a wife and children, two daughters, I believe. And you've seen her interviewed his wife, his widow, and she flat out said, yeah, I'm mad. This was preventable. This was a failure. And then, of course, you start wondering, was this planned? Was this orchestrated? Was this something involving the Secret Service, or were they intentionally just mishandled this situation? So I saw one report, help me out here, where one of the Secret Service agents was like brand new, had never done this before and was responsible like for clearing and preparing the area, whatever they describe the term.
At least part of the area, yeah.
Yeah. And seems like that when you've got a former president and a candidate for president, you kind of want somebody with some experience involved. I could see a new person, a greener person, handling some aspect of it that maybe didn't pose as much risk and threat, but not casing the area and making sure that everything was in tip-top, button-down, secure shape, but not posting someone on that roof? How do you miss that? That's pretty glaring. I mean, I don't think I got to be in the Secret Service to figure that out. Wait, there's a roof up there that has a clear view of the stage where the president's going to be. We might ought to think about putting somewhere up there. That doesn't seem
or at
like...
the very least, restricting access.
Well, right. Sure. So that nobody can get to the roof. I mean, that just seems common sense. I don't think I've got to go through a bunch of training to get that part. Nonetheless, she rightfully is mad. I mean, she went from, you know, the range of emotions, of course, when you lose your spouse, the love of your life, as she referred to him. You know, that she said, yeah, this fool took the love of my life and left my daughters without a father. She has every right to be mad because this was preventable. So, that's the report.
Oh, yeah, there were text messages flying back and forth between law enforcement officers and Secret Service agents before Trump even took the stage about a potential threat.
Yeah, they knew or had some idea. There was chatter, buzz, right? I'm sure there are policies that require some sort of action to be taken. Maybe it's beefing up of the security. Maybe it's double, triple, quadruple check. Maybe it's going even beyond just the normal layers of security to absolutely make sure. But that didn't happen. So, 1 year. I think the president, it changed him. It's made him, I think, more resilient. And it really had galvanized Republicans. Remember, the RNC was a week later. I was there, and I remember distinctly that you just feel the energy and the momentum and the unity of the party. It's just, it's not only that this idiot, this deranged fool, attempted to assassinate, and that's most important, no doubt, a human being. In this case, the former president and a candidate. But we have to ensure that the rule of law prevails. You cannot have a functioning society if you have renegades and rebels like this that just are able to take pot shots at figures such as a former president. That's what happens in these banana republics, which is probably too kind of a word to use for those dysfunctional, corrupt countries. But it's a slap in the face of the country that this person was able to get in position to even take that shot. And by the grace of God, missed the target, honestly. So I think we could at least put it to bed from the standpoint that, yep, there were a series of failures, oversights, breakdowns in communication, and chalk it up for what it is. And let's hope that our Secret Service, our law enforcement, are better, have recovered, have implemented policy and procedure to ensure this never, ever happens again. And it seems like a lot of that stuff's fairly straightforward and fairly simple. But that's where we are. And the president, of course, attended soccer matches yesterday. He said he wants to eliminate the word football in describing the sport and call it soccer. What do you think about that? Because I know you're a fan.
I'm fine with that. I mean, Americans call it soccer.
Yeah.
The Brits try to shame Americans for calling it soccer, but we adopted the word soccer from the Brits because the Brits used to call it soccer. They started calling it football to differentiate themselves so they could look down their noses at us.
That's so true.
Forget about it. They still haven't beat us at a World Cup match. So we can call it whatever the heck we want to.
Well, he was at MetLife Stadium yesterday, right?
Yeah, it was for the Club World Cup final with Chelsea and Paris Saint-Germain. And then he stayed in the picture, because usually when a team wins, they give them the trophy, and then they all gather around the trophy and lift the trophy, and that's when they take the big picture of all them celebrating the trophy. Well, Trump was on stage, and it seemed like the FIFA president was trying to get him off, but the goalkeeper was like, hey, are you cool here? All right, celebrate! And he's on stage clapping with him.
I think it's good that on that day, right, that marked the one-year anniversary of the attempt on his life, he's out there just being the president, interacting with the people and enjoying sports, professional sports. I think that's good. Not trying to make some big production out of it. Remember what happened? We're coming right back. Grant Callen with Empower at 11:05.
For a flipping good time.
Yeah. This segment of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by Covington County Hospital in Collins, where your health matters.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
So, often on this program, we've discussed how the various media outlets, how they style their articles, their reports, the headlines they use, the language they use. And when you read certain outlets, let's say that lean left, CNN, as an example, MSNBC, I mean, many more lean left than right, but let's just use them.
You mean the kind of outlets that couldn't be bothered to put that Trump was shot at in their headlines and
get
called out on it?
That's where I'm going here. So, and I've shared before one of the newspapers that I subscribe to, because I'm just curious as to how folks in a very deep blue state think. And, of course, that's somewhat, I guess, skewed by super progressive left-wing media. But nonetheless, and that's the Boston Globe, by the way. So CNN yesterday, their headline, both in their printed reporting and their on-air reporting regarding the one-year anniversary of the Butler, Pennsylvania assassination attempt. This is the CNN headline. Secret Service rushes Trump off stage after he falls at rally. That's what they focused on. That's what how they chose to style this reporting.
That was in their initial push notification.
Okay. So, do they, like, sit around and think up, how can we, like, frame this and term this, and what language can we use to make sure that it really doesn't reflect reality? And what the key takeaway is from this deal is that some nutcase tried to kill the damn president. Can't we get that in the headline somewhere? No, rather than
Well, remember, these are the same people that preach to you about your implicit biases.
That's true.
Without the ability to look in the mirror and realize they hate Orange Man bad so much that they suffer from, quote-unquote, implicit biases.
But it's 2 days, maybe three, removed from the Senate report that clearly indicates lots of breakdowns in management by the Secret Service of this situation, including what you pointed out. They knew a couple of weeks ahead of time. They had some credible reports that something was going on, and they failed to act on that. This is 2 days after we have this scathing report of the Secret Service about this event. And I'm not talking about the entire, I want to be clear, not the entire Secret Service organization, and not continuously, constantly in everything they do, this one event. And that's what matters, because that's what they're writing about, reporting on. And more importantly, we're like a fraction of an inch away from losing the president. But this is how they choose to report it and to style it. How in the world could you say anything that looks remotely positive about the Secret Service 2 days after this report?
Because the talking heads and the pitiful writers in mainstream media are so ate up with Trump derangement syndrome that they can't dare allow any ink to touch their blessed paper or any pixels to appear on their website that might do anything positive for Orange Man Bad.
They're sick. I mean, they don't want us to believe that this...
They're sick, they're twisted, they're pathetic, and they're miserable.
No doubt. Miserable, I think, is the key word there, is that they're an unhappy lot about everything. And every day they look for something else to be unhappy about. It's incredible. And when they attempt to be happy, when it's Joe Biden, for example, in charge, they just lie their rears off about everything. They really do. I shouldn't be shocked anymore. I would just say, wait. Based on what happened a year ago, that's the headline you chose? Now that it has been exposed that the Secret Service failed on multiple fronts, and that's published in a report based on testimony in the United States Senate? What more do you need? Man. Now, kudos to the president who said, I'm satisfied with the report. And at that point, what are you going to say? Because I think what he knows is what we were just saying. Look, this was a breakdown of a few people on a given day at a given event. Overall, I mean, he's been under Secret Service protection for a long time now. Overall, I think he'd tell you, yeah, these are good people. It's pretty good. It's just his nature. He's always going to be positive about law enforcement. They're a form of, a part of law enforcement. Meanwhile, you got the loons on the left who are mad because ICE agents who are trying to protect their lives and the lives of their families are wearing masks. Just consider that for a second. They're mad about that. And by the way, they're doing their job. The Secret Service on that day, July 13th, 2024, didn't do their job. How could you possibly
And the same whack jobs screaming about Secret Service wearing masks are the same whack jobs that justified rioters during the Black Lives Matter riots wearing masks to protect their identity.
Exactly. And they're also the same people who would justify nefarious and malicious people from assembling around the homes of Supreme Court justices and harassing them and their families. They would condone that as well, I'm quite sure. Unbelievable. Well, I don't think most of America is in their camp. I know there are a lot of people that are crazy, just like them. I certainly get that. But I just was disappointed to see that's the way they chose to report on this 1-year anniversary, that they're lauding the Secret Service here And this is a situation where we just found out the United States Senate, under oath testimony, that, yeah, there were lots of breakdowns, lots of failures. And honestly, I don't feel like that those who testified tried to cover it up or tried to refute it. I think they know, yeah, it's a problem. It does make you wonder, though, does it not? Moe sent us something. The biggest flaw in his protection detail was the 5'6" female that was supposed to shield a 6'3" president. And then, and I don't know if that's the same one, I don't think it was, that was responsible for preparing the site. Likely not. Okay. Where there was numerous breakdowns, the one I was referring to that now we've learned was brand new, never done this before. Like, couldn't they do another assignment before you do a rally for the president, the former president, a candidate, a high-profile figure that gets death threats 24 hours a day? Is that the right first assignment? That's just mismanagement 101 there. And it does make you wonder if that was intentional or if there was some DEI garbage. That's what bothers me, is it was this a DEI? Like, to Moses' point, let's put a 5'3 female. Well, they're just as equal as a 6-foot-plus burly experienced male. Because remember, there are no differences, right?
It's how you. The people that believe they're equal have been brainwashed by bleeding heart blowhards.
Well, in this case, literally, it could have resulted in death. Literally, you could submit that DEI kills. And I'm speculating. I don't know if that's the case, but it sure looks fishy, does it not? And Moses is right about that. One of our local networks, he goes on to say, a few weeks ago said almost half of Americans disagree with the big, beautiful bill. I had to ask why they didn't say over half approved of it. And most of that, I would submit, is kind of related to what we're talking about here. It's because of the inaccurate reporting and the hyperbole and the just flat-out lies that are coming from the left. This Senator Slotkin from Michigan, by the way, I've probably watched half a dozen. You go to her social media page, it's nothing but videos of her. They're short. And on the other side of the break, I'm going to call her out on something that she stated in a video concerning the middle class. She's just wrong. They're just factually wrong.
They all live in la-la land. They refuse to accept reality because reality might hurt their widow fee-wee.
Well, then you can't be a U.S. senator, damn it.
I agree.
Right back.
From the now, you're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert, here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Lou Gramm and Foreigner bumping us into this segment. Yeah, so I know a couple of people, Greg and Newton, said this did result in death. I agree, understand. The firefighter, Corey Compatori, and I was just talking about his wife and how upset she is, and she has a right to be so, of course, doing interviews. I was talking specifically about the president, so I'm not discounting the death of that brave firefighter whatsoever. It's horrible, and she has a right to be mad. And now that the report has been released showing these glaring failures on the part of the Secret Service, it just makes you even madder, because you know this was preventable. They got one job, and they failed to discharge it and complete it. That's the way I look at it. So back to the Democrat hyperbole about a lot of stuff, but in particular the big beautiful bill. This is Senator Alyssa Slotkin, and hear what she has to say first about the middle class.
CIA officer and Pentagon official by training, I believe that the single greatest security threat to the United States is not coming from abroad. It's the shrinking middle class here at home, in the middle class in the first place. And this is the thing that many Democrats have, quite frankly, lost touch with. When you can't provide for your kids, you feel anger, you feel shame, you lose your dignity, and you look for something or someone to blame. That anger, that suspicion among Americans, that right there is what I mean by an existential threat.
So this narrative you hear all the time about the shrinking middle class is false. It is true that the middle class in this country has been steadily shrinking. But here's the reason. Because more people have advanced out of the middle class into the upper income ranges. Now, I had you look it up the other day. As I recall from memory, it's half of the median income to twice the median income. Isn't that right? It represents what is commonly accepted as the middle class in this country.
Two-thirds and double.
Okay, two-thirds. My apologies. I said half to double. It's two-thirds to double, so slightly more. So the median income, last I checked, in the country, not Mississippi, but in the country, median household income is about $81,000. Median means half the households have an income less than that, half have an income greater than that, $81,000. So two-thirds of that is what, roughly $55,000, $60,000?
Pew Research says it's $56,600.
There you go, $56,600 to $160,000. If your income's within that range, you're in the middle class. If it's below that $56,000, you're in the low income class. That's how it's usually referred to whenever this is charted. And then if you're above the $160,000, median household income, I should say household income. If you're above that, then you're in the upper income. So here are the facts. In 1967, you hear them talk about the 50s and 60s and 70s, we had this thriving middle class. They're right. There were more people, but there were a whole lot less in the upper incomes because you just didn't have that kind of opportunity. So back then, 54% of American households were considered in the middle class, 1967. Today, it's 38%. And you look at that and say, wow, the middle class has shrunk. That's terrible. There's only one little problem with that argument. In 1967, 13% of American households were in the upper income class. Now it's 40%. 40%. On the low end, it was 32% in 1967. Now it's 21%. So the low income third has shrunk. The middle income third has shrunk. And the high income third has increased dramatically. This is from government data, by the way. This is not Gerard making this up. You're shaking your head. You've seen this. You know this. And I reported a couple of weeks ago about this astonishing new analysis that shows this country minted 1,000 new millionaires per day last year. Yet, Slotkin would have you believe people are just out on the street, that the middle class is just shrinking. She's right, because people are making more money. Now, I know that there are all kinds of exceptions and all kinds of individual circumstances, but this notion that it's because somehow the system, this is what she wants you to believe, the rich people and Donald Trump, they've rigged the system. You can't get ahead. I'm telling you, that's horse hockey. There's more opportunity than ever, and it ain't going to do nothing but get better. Speaking of which, just as an example, how many people right now, today, Rhino, are celebrating their newfound wealth from their investment in Bitcoin? What's it today? 122,000, I think.
Oh, I hadn't even checked.
Yeah, it's up dramatically. Crossed the $120,000 line. 122,000 was the last figure I saw, just as an example. Now, most of the folks who invest in, as you call it, the funny money, they're going to be typically in your age range or younger. They're just more comfortable with that. I mean, that's just statistically proven. And a lot of those are like newfound wealth they never even dreamed possible because of that opportunity, made possible because of the technology that was innovated in this country going back to the dang 60s and moving forward made all this possible. That's what I call creating wealth through American ingenuity and innovation. And the only thing that stops that is the government. So, Senator Slotkin, your solution is more government. And I'm here to tell you that it's less government that creates more opportunity. When the system is rigged, that system is government. They want you to believe that, oh, no, it's all those rich barons of industry, right, sitting back there twiddling their handlebar mustaches. Oh, yeah, I'm going to get... That's horse hockey. That's so untrue. And when you have a thriving economy where job opportunities outweigh people looking for a job, guess who's got the leverage then? Miss, the system is rigged. And guess what causes companies, I know, it's second order thinking. I know. You're going to scold me on this. Well, that requires second. And you're right. She can't figure this out. A U.S. senator can't figure this out.
Or won't.
Won't, that's right. Refuses to. Oh, no, we can't let the private sector do that. It's got to come from government. You tell the private sector, we're getting out of your way. I promise you they will create jobs. Because there's money to be made. They want to tell you, all the tax cuts did, they just gave money to each other in the halls of the executives of these companies. Nonsense. We saw real wages increase under the president's first term by over $6,000. We're already seeing real wages to increase this year. That simply means pay's going up faster than inflation. Under Joe Biden, first 3 years, Americans underwater. It was the fourth year he was in office when finally wage increases outpaced the increase in the cost of living. Net of about $1,000. Increase in real wages over his 4 years. I know, second order thinking. I just get frustrated with this because the people in the audience are all shaking their head. Yeah, I see what you're talking about, Senator. We're just all worse off. That's just horse hockey. Get off your butt and go to work. There's plenty of opportunity. Plenty of opportunity. And the reason for that is we have created this wide range, this plethora, this array of tools that never existed. And they became reality because people went out, took risk, and they innovated, and they got rich doing it. And they can't stand that. They can't stand the fact that these people that went out and created all these tools got wealthy as a result. I know, I'm on the soapbox, but we got to come to grips with reality, and these people don't live in reality whatsoever. And it's maddening, you can tell. I get upset about it. It's like all that time and effort and talk you waste just castigating a system that provides more opportunity than any other on the planet. Do we have work to do? Absolutely. Always. Always, always have work to do. But my gosh, get out of the dang mud and go to work. Go start taking advantage of these opportunities and get rich. It's there for the taking. Coming right back in the Element Well studio, it's Grant Callen at 11:05 today.
Patriotism is a lot.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
That's the great Joe Walsh there when he embarked upon his solo career. Can you imagine all that talent on the stage at the same time in the Eagles? Every one of those guys was so good. I've been digging a little bit of Eagles lately. Sometimes I just dial it up, and then I listen to it and say, man, they were so good. The harmonies we thought
about.
It's
like a super group in reverse.
That's exactly right. We're trying to maybe add one of their songs to our set list in the house band, but we're trying to figure out how to replicate those harmonies, even though we got three great vocalists in our group, I must say. But my favorite Eagles tune, by the way, for what it's worth, is One of These Nights. And I love the falsetto in the song and just the super high vocals. So dang good. I don't know if anybody's willing to try to take that on. Oh, shoot. What was his name that was in the band for a while? You and I talked about it a couple of weeks ago that handled a lot of that. Of course, you had Don Henley on the drums that was doing a lot of the singing. And then Joe Walsh chimes in, who has kind of a high voice. Was it Gary? I can't remember his name. That's terrible. Because he was in and out.
Randy Meisner.
I said Gary. Yeah, that's it. So, because I did do a little research. I said, like, who's doing this, you know? Because I could detect Henley. And it turns out it was Meisner. It's adding a lot.
Oh, yeah. Like in Take It to the Limit.
Yeah, same deal. He's just got a fantastic, like, would that be a tenor voice, I guess, or?
I believe it's called falsetto.
Well, yeah, falsetto. Yeah, I got that, but tenor plus falsetto is what I'd say. So if he's singing, like, with the full breath, maybe tenor, but falsetto.
I think with proper training, it doesn't matter what range you're in, your falsetto is going to be pretty much the same.
Okay, gotcha.
It just, the farther down your range goes, the harder it would be to train a falsetto.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes sense, yeah. So I guess I'm assuming you sort of start out as a natural tenor and then maybe perfect.
Most of the time, yeah.
But golly, that's so good. It's just unbelievable how good that was. And, you know, I got to tell you, when I'm walking with my dog and I've got my nice Beats headphones on, which are really good because they cover your ears. And when you listen to that, like, man, this is really good. It's the next best thing to being in the studio, I would say. It's just incredible.
We got to get you some Sennheiser or some Bose or some of the, because Beats are good.
Yeah.
I won't knock them. They're just a little bit too pricey for their quote unquote sound quality.
Okay.
They're exceedingly focused on bass boost.
I agree.
And that's only a third of the mix.
Okay. Well, I do have some rather expensive Bose Buds. Just got them. Wireless. They're way better than, like, the Apple Buds.
Oh, yeah.
They're not cheap, as you know, but the quality is excellent. I also just bought, I've got a little JBL speaker that I hang on my golf cart that we listen to a little music.
The quality of those has definitely gone up since they first came out.
I agree. Okay, so you got to look this up. You may be familiar with it. It's called a Turtle Box. Have you seen those things?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And so they've got one that's like built for a golf cart. It's got a magnet on it. You know, attaches. That's like a concert riding around on your golf cart.
If I'm not mistaken, it uses the same technology that you would see at a concert, just miniaturized. It's kind of like a little mini array.
Okay.
And if you've ever been to a concert and you've seen them hanging just this stack of speakers.
Right.
That kind of curve when they get to the bottom or get to the top.
Yes.
That's a stack of arrays.
Yeah.
And the whole point of an array is it's focusing the sound into a cone in front of it so that you have the most precise audio to that cone, and then you stack a bunch of them to cover more of an area. So you get that precision sound in a much smaller package with the Turtle Box.
Yeah. It's amazing. I will say that. Not cheap, by the way. And they got different little form factors of them. So, yeah, Randy Meisner and then later Timothy B. Schmidt falsetto. Man, I can't tell you why Timothy B. Schmidt, the bassist in Eagles for the Eagles. Wow, that's so good. So good. Yeah, appreciate there. So, Matt Burnsville says Sennheiser.
They're what I'm wearing, and there's a reason, as beat up as these things are, I still use them.
Yeah.
They're the best.
Good stuff.
To me.
Yeah. I remember when I was, I think, in high school or maybe middle school, when Bose, Dr. Bose introduced the famous Bose speakers that you had to set up by a wall because it projected backwards, used the wall to reflect off of. That was kind of their deal.
Yeah, Bose kind of pioneered the concept of moving sound in a different way than just moving the membrane of the speaker.
That's
to
right.
Move the sound.
Yeah, exactly. I tell you, who else kind of pioneered some of that? Polk Audio had some interesting technology. This was probably 35, 40 years ago. My favorite, Martin Logan. You ever heard of those? The electrostatic speakers? Unbelievable. Super expensive. They're top of the line. $100,000 for a pair of speakers. We got a press release from the Mississippi Democrat Party. We'll get to that later on in the program. Right now, it's time for Fox News and Super Talk News, and then it's Grant Callen, founder and CEO of Empower Mississippi.
Hour of Middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by the Mississippi Business Journal. Visit msbusinessjournal.com. Scott Coopwood, publisher and president.
And now, the talk that keeps Mississippi talking.
That's what I like to listen to.
You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert. Here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays from the Element Wealth Studio. We appreciate you so much for joining us. It's hour two of the program. Don't forget, it's a Monday. That means we'll be with you, I should say, for 2 hours. It's Super Talk Outdoors with Ricky Matthews at 12:05. But right now, it's Grant Callen, founder and CEO of Empower Mississippi. So, Grant, you were just telling me that you heard me go off on a bit of a rant there. About just the economy in the country and the just broad opportunities that we all have in front of us. It's just a matter of just picking yourself up by the bootstraps and taking advantage of that. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, I thought it was a great segment. And the thought I wanted to add was simply that through the history of the world, slavery, tyranny, hardship was just kind of commonplace, and the station you were born into was the station you died into. And if you were born in poverty, that's where you'd spend your life. You were born in the middle class, you got lucky, or you're born in the aristocrat, you got lucky and you did better. The thing that was so radical about the Declaration of Independence and this experiment with freedom was where you're born is not where you have to stay. And you're exactly right. The middle class is shrinking, and it's because more people are moving into the upper class. And the thing that's so dramatic and so revolutionary about what we've seen in recent history is that there is opportunity in America. And I would say in the last few years, we've seen incredible opportunity in Mississippi that you don't have to stay where you are. There is opportunity for people to climb. And that seems so like common sense to us because we're Americans and we've lived here all our life and you started a company here. But that's a pretty radical idea when you think about the history of human civilization. Being able to climb out of your station and achieve something better than your parents or grandparents did is an incredibly radical idea.
No doubt about it. Why do you think so many on the left, I got started on this because of video that I viewed published by Senator Slotkin of Michigan. And she says that the shrinking middle class is an existential threat, to the country. But that ignores the reality of, the middle class is shrinking because more people are moving out of the middle class upward more so than the people that are even moving from the lower classes are into the middle class. So, I mean, it is shrinking the middle class, though there are more people growing out of the lower classes to the middle class, far more going from the middle class to the upper class. It almost feels like they can't accept that people are able to improve their situation without government.
Right, because government didn't create a program that pulled people out of poverty. The program that has pulled people out of poverty is free trade and free market economics, and it is the number one most successful global poverty program in the history of the planet that free markets, free trade, capitalism, the ability that you can make a product, that you can have property rights, that they don't, that government doesn't just hand you property rights. Property rights come from God, and government exists to protect those, has created more wealth for everybody. And in fact, the number, you know, the percentage of people across the planet that are living on, what is it, $2 a day has increased dramatically over the last 50 years. So I think that's what the left often forgets, is that, well, I'd say two things. One, they forget that just because the markets produce it, that's not something – I mean, they don't want to celebrate it simply because it didn't come from the top down. It came from the bottom up. But I think the other thought is, it's not to say that those – the opportunity and the access to opportunity has always in America been universal, or it's been equally accessible. There are we haven't always been perfect in that. There are people and there are races that in this country have had more opportunity than others. But what you can see throughout our history is progress, and tremendous progress. And even people in this country that we would say are in the lowest class, that are in poverty, they are doing better. Their quality of life is better than they would have been 60, 70 years ago. And that's progress. That doesn't mean our work is done. You said that. It means we've got to continue to fight for opportunity for everybody. And really, that's what, to me, that's what our work at Empower is about, is making sure opportunity doesn't just exist for those that are in the upper class. We got to make sure opportunities exist to everybody, whether that's a great education, whether that's work, rebuilding your life after prison. But you're right. Their opportunity is out there if people are willing to take hold of it.
Yeah. And we should distinguish between equal opportunity and equity of outcomes like this, you know. So that's
100%. Right. And I think that's fundamentally where conservatives and progressives differ. Where progressives often want to see equality of outcome. And it's just a misunderstanding of human nature to think that government could do that anyway. If you were to level the playing field today, which I'm not recommending, but taking from the rich and giving to the poor and leveling everybody, in 5 minutes, it would be unlevel.
Yeah.
Because some people would invest their money. Some people would spend it. Some people would build a company. Some people wouldn't. So what we can't do equality of outcome. That's never been possible. What we can do is equality of opportunity, which is give people access to a fair judicial system, a equitable education system, give people the tools to work hard, take bets, make investments, open companies. There is a lot of work to do to get government out of the way. Let's reduce the red tape and the regulation that stands in the way of people opening a company. Let's make sure that every kid in our state has access to a great education. That's not always been done. It's not being done today. But we've made tremendous progress, and that's certainly worthy of celebrating.
And we have to recognize that. I mean, and again, it doesn't mean, okay, we're done, stop, job complete. Not that. Nobody's suggesting that. But you also have to take stock in the fact that, as you pointed out, even the poor in this country, we don't want anybody to be poor. Let's be honest.
Right.
We want everybody to thrive and to be economically successful, but they're better off than the middle class to the wealthy in other countries by orders of magnitude. I mean, the things that in this country we just take for granted would be reserved, like having a flat screen TV and a cell phone, a washer and a dryer. I don't, you name it, all the modern conveniences that we're accustomed to, a roof over your head. As an example, and food to eat. We've got pretty dang good safety nets and very charitable people that ensure that, whereas in other countries, they're literally looking for a roof over their head, something to put on their body, and food to eat 24 hours a day.
And I think for some, our commitment to helping people in poverty, they measure that purely by the amount of money you put into government programs and how accessible those are.
Yeah.
And I would say you and I know the best, most productive quality of life things happen when people earn their own success.
No doubt.
And that's not to say we don't have a safety net program for people who are disabled, who are unable to earn their own success, but that can't be the norm. The norm ought to be, let's create a landscape where everybody who wants to achieve the American dream can do it. And that means using your God-given gifts. That means finding a way to create value in your community or in the economy, using your God-given gifts to produce value in a product or service that other people want. And when you do that, people build a life of purpose and meaning, and it's not something that was handed to them that they could lose tomorrow if Congress decides to slash benefits. It's something they built and they can be really proud of, and they can invest and save money and hand it off to the next generation.
It, well said. It feels like the impediment to that, however, are people like Senator Slotkin and many others on the left, as you say, that always look to government programs as the solution. And they're constantly promoting this message, this narrative, this rhetoric that you're just the deck stacked against you, and it's all because of these group of people, whatever, or these sort of politicians. And they have come to accept, I guess, that government's going to come to their rescue and their aid, and they're going to thrive on that rather than on their own.
Well, and I know we're coming up on a break, yeah. But I'll just say, it used to be real clean cut what the right believed and the left believed. The right doesn't always believe and defend this stuff well either. And there's a lot of folks on the right that would claim to be conservative that aren't standing up for free markets and free trade and all those things.
We
got
to clean that up. We got Grant Callen, founder and CEO of Empower Mississippi. When we come back, we'll talk about a key education provision in the big, beautiful bill. Stay with us.
Days with Gerard Gibbert.
Let's do this.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
Let's go.
The blues has got a hold of me. I believe I'm getting dizzy. Help me up. I keep thinking.
Little ZZ Top, that'll get your blood flowing there. We're back with you in the Element Well studio. It's Grant Callen, founder and CEO of Empower Mississippi. So enjoy that discussion and totally agree with you. And you're right that we have some people on the right, Republicans, and we don't want to call attention to any particular people, but in general, we got a little work to do to get them to think more like good free market capitalists as well. That and maybe it's the bug of government. You know, sometimes they get involved in government, and that's your tool. I mean, that's what you have available to you is more government. And you think about solving problems with government where the opposite's usually the best solution.
And I think just because free markets are not perfect,
sure,
and we have had financial problems. Are you thinking about the housing crisis or there have been – that doesn't mean – because the free markets aren't perfect, that we throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Right.
And there are some that are so quick to say, we got to move past free markets. We got to move past free trade. We got to move to other it's not that these things have tried and failed. It's that they've often tried and we gave up on them too quick.
Yeah. So let's turn our attention to the president's signature legislation signed into law, the so-called Big Beautiful Bill, on July 4th, fittingly, I think, included a provision that's not getting quite the attention that many of the others are included in the legislation. But this involves a tax credit, $1,700 tax credit for individuals who contribute to a fund administered by private organizations that would then grant scholarships, if you will, to students to use those funds to attend private school. This is something that's brand new. This is not like a federal scholarship or a federal voucher. It's just a tax credit,
right,
if you contribute. So talk about that.
Well, so it is the school choice provision that was in that bill, and it's something that the president has championed and a lot of education groups has championed. But it's important to mention, so school choice really is a state issue because we don't want the federal government handing out ESAs or vouchers or stuff like that. Most of education funding comes from the states. But this was a way to do for the federal government to lean into something that I think is within their role that is important. So it's a tax credit. It's not a tuition tax credit, which would be actually to families who are, you know, paying tuition and some kind of credit on their taxes.
Yeah.
And it's not a school tax credit, kind of like the Children's Promise Act in Mississippi. You mentioned it. It is a credit for people who donate to scholarship-granting organizations.
SGOs, they call them.
SGOs.
Yeah.
And the idea is that if you can make it a lot more compelling for people to donate to these SGOs, many that already exist, and we could talk about some of those, or I'm certain there'll be new ones created, they will have a lot more money. They will be able to donate to kids who can't afford private school tuition. And so it's kind of a interesting way to incentivize people, the private landscape, private philanthropers, really just ordinary Americans, to donate to these scholarship granting organizations so then they can help low-income kids afford private school. So some of the mechanics of this, states have to opt in. By our reading of the bill, it looks to us like the governor can opt in. There's some debate about whether the legislature has to opt in or the governor. It looks to me like it's just the governor would have to do it. I'm sure there'll be some states that do not participate. It is a $1,700 cap on each individual that can contribute.
Per year.
Per year. That's right. So you're not going to grow. This is not going to grow overnight. It's going to take a lot of donors across a state or really across the country to contribute to a pot that then would be able to give money out to kids. Now, one of the requirements on the scholarship granting organization is they can only give these scholarships to students in a family that is up to 300% of the federal poverty level.
No, it's actually the median income of the area.
Oh, okay.
It's not the federal poverty level. It's the median, but that it's a little different calculation. But just want to clarify that.
The intent is to focus on low-income kids.
That's the main point.
Right.
Yeah. So
it's not about serving. You hear all the time, well, school choice is about wealthy kids already in private school.
Yeah.
No, this is about helping the kids that need it but can't afford it.
Yeah, that's right.
I think I think this is something that is going to take a couple of years to really we'll see develop. It doesn't even come online until 2027. So we got next year to work on this.
Yeah.
But I think it's a way to help kids across the country that want to get into a private school that can't afford it to do so.
But in your reading of the bill, you think maybe the governor of a state can just opt into it without necessitating legislative approval. That would be a big deal in Mississippi.
Yeah, there's a provision that talks about the governor could do it or an entity that is usually responsible, I'm paraphrasing, for opting into federal programs.
Okay.
So I'll let the attorneys figure out who can actually do it, but I'm certain we have a governor who will support it, and I think our legislature would support it as well.
Okay.
But let's be clear, this is not a replacement for some of the work that I know House and Senate leaders are working on right now on school choice.
Right.
This is good. It's important. I think it's a tool in the toolbox. It will be helpful. It's going to take a long time before it really ramps up and actually helps a meaningful number of kids, whereas some of the proposals that lawmakers are considering would help kids on day one.
Yeah. Yeah, so a school choice program, the robust school choice program in the state of Mississippi, that would allow state funds to follow the student to their setting of choice is a different matter than an SGO that provides a scholarship to those who apply for it using the monies contributed that, from individuals who get the $1,700 credit.
That's right. And there are some states that already provide a state credit for contributions to these scholarship granting organizations. Louisiana does that. Georgia does that. And they're, Alabama does that actually too, and they have some great organizations that have that administer that and administer that. They're these SGOs. So I think we could see some of those organizations grow into other states. I think some would be interested in coming into Mississippi. I think there'll be some homegrown people here.
Yeah,
that
I agree.
Would probably want to start a scholarship granting organization. And you could have it. There's no limit in the number of scholarship granting organizations that could participate.
Right.
I think one of the provisions is the governor has to list which are the authorized scholarship granting organizations.
Okay.
So you could have a list, but. Alabama already has multiple organizations that do this for their state credit, and now you'll have this federal credit on top of to kind of further incentivize contributions. So,
okay.
I think it's a great thing. It is certainly going to help more kids afford private school,
okay.
And we just need to make sure we get it approved, opted in for Mississippi, and then start working with whoever wants to start these scholarship granting organizations to make sure. That they're set up well, and the money gets to the kids. One of the provisions is 90% of the money has to go to scholarships.
Right.
So you can't spend a bunch of it on overhead.
Administration, right. Let's talk about the status of the charter school program in the state of Mississippi. Empower, of course, heavily involved in policy around that. What's the status now? How many charter schools do we have?
Yeah, so there are 10 that are up and running, and there are 2 more that have been authorized but have not opened yet.
Okay.
And I'll just tell you, for folks who are listening, if you haven't been to tour one of these, I highly recommend it. It's kind of hard to understand what a charter is until you just walk in the door and you see what they're doing. The landscape has grown a lot slower, as I know you know and our audience knows. It's grown slower than we wanted. One of the provisions for that is that to open a charter, you have to be in a district rated D or F. That's on the state's accountability model, A, B, C, D, or F. And as more and more districts have – really, I think some of that is inflation, where we only – out of 140 school districts, there are only 3 districts in the state now that have
D or F.
A D or F.
Yep.
That has meant it's very hard for people to open charters today.
Yep.
But you should go look at the charters that exist. Ambition Prep is the last charter I was in. I was in their building a couple of weeks ago. D. Archie Scott is the head of school there. That is over on Clinton Boulevard in a high, high poverty part of the state, part of the city of Jackson. And they're just serving kids every day, and their kids are thriving. They're a B-rated school. Kids are coming out. They're being prepared for life. They're doing great things. They have a waiting list to get in.
Hmm.
They're growing every year. They're going to be adding more grades. They're working to add a high school. It's a great opportunity. And as I talked to D. Archie, who's the head there, he said, look, this has never been about being against public school. We are a public school. This is about serving kids that maybe were on the verge of dropping out or kids that needed a little something different. And they're doing it. And I think they're 400 and something kids now. They're growing up to 700.
At Ambition Prep?
At Ambition Prep.
Wow.
So it's huge.
I had no idea.
They're big.
That is awesome. So, and talk about an organization associated with Empower.
From the Seabird.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
It is on.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
The iconic voice, Steve Perry there, Oh Sherry, from his solo career. What a cheesy video that was. It's pretty good, though. We're back with you in the Element Well studio with Grant Callen, founder and CEO of Empower Mississippi. So we had a little glitch there in the technology, and we're cut off. But we were talking about Ambition Prep.
Yep.
You mentioned that their enrollment is over 400.
It's at, I just looked it up, 472 kids.
That's impressive.
This and is that's the current year. So my expectation is they will grow in for the fall and then continue to grow. I think their goal is to get to mid 700s by the time they add a high school.
Wow, that's incredible. And this is in West Jackson off Clinton Boulevard. And that's just amazing. So I recall, I told you on the break, I grew up not far from there off of Bowling Street. Used to have friends in that area, ride my bike around there and stuff. But there was a public elementary school right near there, the intersection, called Rains, and it's no longer there. So I would argue that this school opening up right there is kind of a godsend, because that means those kids that typically went to Rains, that lived close to Rains, now have to travel a little further to get to the nearest public school that might be open. But they have this option if they can get on board at a charter school. And again, tell our audience, Grant, that charter schools are, in fact, public schools. They're not private schools, is widely believed. Explain that.
They are public schools. They simply are independent of the district. They are held accountable, just like a public school. They have to take the same state test that traditional public schools have to take. They are funded like a public school. These are tuition-free schools. So students come, they choose to come to a charter school, and then the charter funding, I mean, the public school funding follows the student, and they get paid based on the number of kids that come. So if they, you know, like in this case, Ambition has 472 kids, they are getting funded the per student amount for 472 kids.
From the state. From the state,
correct. Yeah. But they're getting state and local. I think the way the funding flows, it comes from the state, but they get the same amount. So they are funded the same way. They get 97% of what the traditional public
school. Because they're a public school.
That's right. They're a public school. And look, this is just one example. There are six charter schools in Jackson. Ambition Prep is one. Midtown Public Charter School is another. I'm looking at the numbers. As of the current semester, there's 2,783 kids in the city of Jackson in a charter school. And it has really been extraordinary. Not that every kid needs to go to a charter. The goal is not to replace traditional public, but it's to give families a choice, give families an option where they might want to try something different. And you know, D'Archie Scott is the head of school at Ambition that we've started talking about, and he's extraordinary. He's an entrepreneur. He's an educator by trade who said, I want to use my gifts to educate more kids, and I want to have the freedom to do it outside the traditional public school sector. In fact, I have a whole – you should have him on. I had him on my podcast a couple weeks ago, and we had a long interview with him. And he's just a great innovator, and he's figured out how to help kids achieve great things, even in an incredibly high-poverty part of the state.
And you indicated that they have a waiting list. Is that right?
They do.
Right now.
They do.
So the fact that they have 472 students – now, these are students that could attend the public school that they're attached to. They've chosen to enroll in this school. And the fact that enrollment stays high like that, and they got a waiting list, they must be doing something right.
And they could go back tomorrow if they weren't getting pleased.
Right.
You know, I asked D'Archie, I said, charters have so, there's all this sort of political baggage that comes with the word charter. I said, how do you experience that? What do your families think about this school? And he said, they don't even know this is controversial. He's like,
I bet that's right.
They just see this bright, clean, safe, high-achieving charter school in a high-poverty community, and they're just grateful. He's like, we don't get involved in politics. He said, and maybe that's part of the challenge of charters at the Capitol, is that charters are just doing their job educating kids, and they're not spending time on politics, spreading the good word. But it's been life-changing for these kids.
That's awesome.
And that's why they want to add a high school, so that the kids don't have to go back to a traditional public high school, but they can stay with these kids all the way through the end of their high school experience.
So one of the challenges, as you pointed out, is that charter schools in Mississippi can only locate in D and F districts. We have, 142 districts, three of which are now D and F. So the only options for new charter schools to form up would be in those three districts.
Yeah, and we're basically just stagnant. There is not. We're in the middle of a charter application cycle, and there are zero applicants right now, simply because there's no place for you to go.
So there's an effort to expand that to, we like to have it available in any district, regardless of their grade, but at a minimum, add the C districts to that. But that's been met with some resistance in the state Senate.
It has. And let's be honest, it's not just the state Senate. It passed the House, but it was a close vote.
You're right.
It was a tough vote.
Yeah. Speaker favors it, though.
He absolutely does. I think he favors, let's create opportunity for kids everywhere.
Yeah.
And charters are a big part of that. My word to the legislature would be, let's find a way to allow charters to open in more communities. They've been a godsend to the communities where they are. They've been great for the city of Jackson. There's one in Greenwood. There's one in Clarksdale. There's one in Canton. There's one in Natchez. As I mentioned, there are two more that have been approved in the Delta to open. There are just more communities that need them. And we've got to find a way to allow charters to open in more communities. And you were asking me about Embark. Embark is a program we started to come alongside people that want to start schools. So it's a nonprofit that serves school founders across Mississippi. If you want to start a charter school or if you want to start a private school, we want to help you get your school idea off the ground. And we have a pipeline of people that are talented, interested in opening charters, that some of them are educator by training, some of them are parents, some of them are business people, business-minded people. There's simply nowhere for them to go because there's only three districts in the state you can open. So we'd love to see that open up. And one of the things that hasn't been done but I'd love to see happen is charters don't have to just open. If they got permission from a school district, they could open anywhere. So I would love to see school districts not see this as a threat, but see this as something they could partner with and maybe provide an industry-specific model. Maybe you want to do a career technical education school, or maybe you want to do a pre-med school, or maybe you want to do something else. You could do that in conjunction with the district, and that's not limited today. That wouldn't even require legislation. You could do that today if you got permission from the district to open.
Marquee legislation passed in the past session that will phase out the income tax in the state of Mississippi. Empower was involved in that effort, advocated very strongly for that, finally got that across the finish line. Why is this important in the state of Mississippi?
Oh, it's incredibly important, and it took real courage to get it done. There are 9 states that don't have an income tax that are thriving economically. Aside from Alaska, none of those states ever had an income tax. Alaska's the only one that ever successfully eliminated it, and they struck oil. So they had some advantages, some advantages to their economy to eliminate it. I'm really proud of the leadership it took on both sides of the Capitol to get this done, and the governor leading the charge for this, because it was a prudent, methodical, I think wise way to phase it out. We didn't flip a switch and pull the rug out. We said, a third of the state budget is made up on income tax, so we need to phase that out over a number of years. This plan will do that, and I think you will start to see Mississippi continue to be a place where capital wants to come and people with capital want to come. And I mean, just even the last couple of years, as we've started stepping down the income tax and making other changes, we've seen Mississippi become a magnet for economic development. I think this is just going to expedite that process, and it's really going to put Mississippi in a new category. There's a lot of states working on this, a lot of states trying to get rid of their income tax. We're the first state who did it, put the win on the board, and it's worth celebrating, worth crowing about.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Other states are taking a hard look at this, and Mississippi got it done. It's gotten national news as well, and people are taking notice. So we're leading in that respect. But we're a white space with respect to school choice, with all the states surrounding us enacting robust school choice legislation, the latest of which was Texas, which was a momentous victory. But we got to get that done.
We're going to get there. I am confident we're going to get there. If you are listening and you want school choice, tell your legislator.
Yeah.
Let's
appreciate do it. That. Grant Callen, founder and CEO of Empower Mississippi, the state's leading advocate for school choice and many other important issues as well. Appreciate it, Grant.
Thanks for having me on. Enjoyed it.
You got it. We're coming right back, folks, with a final segment. Stay with us.
Poly up a Mississippi.
Are we going to do this?
Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Keep rolling. 3, 2, 1.
On Super Talk Mississippi.
So the Dow has turned around. It's in the green now. In fact, all the indexes are. The president not happy with Jerome Powell. I did catch an interview. He's, of course, chairman of the Federal Reserve. I caught an interview this morning on the Business Channel with the Cleveland Fed president. I think it's Beth Hammack. Yeah, that's her. And the question was about her thoughts on cutting rates. And this is something I've been paying attention to for a long time. I feel like maybe I've introduced you to this idea of watching the Fed, which is what the markets do. So you know how many times I've shared that they have these little code words and things? This morning, the word I picked up on was restrictive. She wouldn't just come out and say, no, we ain't cutting rates. She just said, restrictive monetary policy. Oh, my gosh. Bottom line is there's no consensus among the Fed governors. That's what's clear. Should we or should we not cut rates? And she was very noncommittal, other than saying, I still think we need to have restrictive policy to drive inflation down to our 2% target. And it's sitting at around 2.5, 2.6. The president says it needs to be the Fed funds rate, the benchmark interest rate, which is now 4.25 to 4.5, needs to be 1% today. But she wasn't yielding. She didn't seem too interested in voting for a rate cut. So we'll see. Markets are certainly tuned into that. She's still concerned that even though to date we haven't seen any major inflation as a result of tariffs, she is concerned that we hadn't seen the last of it yet, that we still are going to see inflation. Now, she did say, for what it's worth, she's in the Rust Belt up there in Cleveland, that she's been talking to folks in the steel industry, and they are experiencing significant increase. She said 23%. That's significant increase in the price of imported steel. And that, of course, figures into the cost of lots of other goods that are made with that as a raw material component with steel. So she's hearing anecdotally, I guess you could say, from people who are on the ground, dealing with tariffs. And of course, you got the 50% tariff on copper we talked about last week, and now 30% on the EU. And there's rumors, you've seen this, Rhino, that Canada and Japan and the EU are sort of getting together to kind of craft an orchestrated, coordinated response. There is one thing that this is crazy, guys, that Japan has that's now being rumored to be prospectively in their arsenal to deal with tariffs, and that is to the surprise of many, they own more of our debt than any other foreign country. Most people think China owns overwhelmingly a big chunk of our debt. Not true. China owns right now about $700 billion of the total $36 trillion, so less than 2% of it. Japan, on the other hand, has about $1.2 trillion, $500 billion or so more than China. So the concern is that they're going to start reducing their balance sheet of U.S. debt and not buying as much, and that causes yields to rise, and that's problematic for interest rates. You see where I'm going with this? Maybe this is a little second-order thinking that the Democrats may need. But nonetheless, there ain't no love lost between the president and Jerome Powell. I think somewhere in the middle is the right strategy. And what really does bother, and you've pointed this out many, many times, is that, okay, well, it was okay when you reduced rates right before the election when we were at that point about, what, 4.5%, 5% inflation. Now we're 2.5%, and you're saying it's still too high. So the inconsistency of the application of policy does at least make one scratch their heads. Maybe Powell is a political hack. It's what it's looking like.
No. Somebody from the D.C. swamp having a political bias? No.
When Thomas points out, cut spending and interest rates are immaterial. Not true, Thomas, because we still have $36 trillion of debt. Even if we cut spending to balance the budget today, we still have $36 trillion of debt, of which some $9 trillion is terming out this year. And this is what the president's concerned about. That debt's going to have to be refinanced at, in some cases, double the interest rate it is currently financed at. And so our interest tab is going to increase rather significantly, even if we didn't add another dime to the debt, which is not going to happen. So more on that tomorrow. I've got some other stuff to talk about tomorrow with respect to the big, beautiful bill and some things that are expiring and how we could keep them from expiring, like the additional standard deduction and tips and overtime, stuff like that. But we're out of here today. It's time for Fox News, Super Talk News. Then Ricky Matthew will get you with Super Talk Outdoors back tomorrow. Stay safe and God bless everyone.
Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.